The UFC rankings, they're a joke. And I come to this after UFC 279, looking at the welterweight rankings in specific. Because we saw Li Jinglang lose his ranking in a catchweight fight of 180 pounds to Daniel Rodriguez. Now I know Jinglang weighed in at the welterweight limit, made the welterweight limit. He weighed in, but he weighed in for a welterweight fight that did not happen because of all the shakeup that took place at UFC 279. And with that, that fight was, again, no longer a welterweight fight. Rodriguez weighed 179 for a 180-pound catchweight fight. And right there, at that moment, the rankings shouldn't have even been in play. But they were, I guess, for some reason. I don't know, maybe the UFC just decided to leave the rankings pool open and Rodriguez available to be ranked at welterweight because his last fight, which was like more than a year ago, was at welterweight. And the whole thing was a farce and kind of a joke. And I don't like the UFC rankings because, number one, it's the UFC rankings and it's not MMA rankings. And that there, it's a promotional ranking, not an overall ranking. So that shouldn't even be a consideration, really. And the rankings pool, if you look at who is involved with the whole ranking system, you're not going to see a long list of the top people who cover MMA. You're going to see some, maybe some recognizable names, but for the most part in that rankings pool, you're not going to recognize many names, if any names at all. And so I have a hard time taking those rankings seriously because of that and because of their promotional ranking. Another reason I don't take them all that serious is because you are doing work for the UFC if you're in that rankings pool for free. And I don't think that the media should be doing work for a promotion for free or at all. Now, if these were independent rankings that took into account everybody and every promotion, I'd have a different outlook on this, but these are promotional rankings. There's a whole bunch of suspicions that could come into that, but that's not really what I'm focusing on here. I'm focusing on the fact that this fight should not have been available to be ranked, and Rodriguez shouldn't have been in the mix for the rankings, and that the bigger picture here is that there's no transparency. I want truly independent and truly transparent rankings. We don't have either of those things in this case, and therefore the rankings shouldn't be taken seriously, but the promotion seems to take them seriously because they put them on the broadcast, and the fighters take them seriously because, well, it carries a little weight if you have a number behind your name. Those are just the facts from the perception of the UFC and the fighters. That's the reality of the situation. But I just don't get it. I don't understand why this happened. And that's the lack of transparency. We used to be able to go back and see who voted for who and what they voted for and how they voted and track that. We don't have that anymore. So there's no accountability here. There's no way I can say or anyone can say, so-and-so, why did you move Li Jinglang out of the rankings and replace him with Daniel Rodriguez in a fight that was not at the weight that you made this change in the rankings? Because I'm genuinely interested. If the answer is just because Rodriguez beat him, that's not sufficient because he didn't beat him at welterweight. He beat him at catchweight that was closer to middleweight than it is to welterweight. And if the answer is that the UFC just included Rodriguez in the welterweight rankings, that's the UFC's fault. So there's a lot of blame to go around here. But the man who's most harmed by what happened is Li Jinglang, who arguably won that fight to begin with. Now, I know the judges scored it otherwise, but it was a close fight. So even if the situation was that it was a welterweight fight, does Rodriguez deserve to replace Jinglang? I don't think so. So this is a whole nightmare scenario that shouldn't have even come into play. Ideally, Jinglang would remain in the rankings. Rodriguez would remain outside the rankings until he fights at welterweight. Because again, he did not fight or weigh in even close to welterweight in this for this fight. And that should be a disqualifying factor from the jump. I hope the UFC corrects this situation. But further, I hope the UFC shows a little more transparency in here so at least we know who voted for what that week. And transparency is not always the best thing. But in this case, I think it is because it allows us to ask the questions that need to be asked. Why was this move made in a fight that didn't take place at the weight you moved the rankings? I don't understand it, and I wish someone would answer it, but I'm not counting on that happening. Let's go over some of the good and the bad things that happened at UFC 279, and these are not related to the fighters per se, but more so the broadcast team, the broadcast, and the UFC. So the first thing I want to do is praise the UFC production team. And I think we at times take the UFC production team for granted, but they do a lot of hard work getting these videotages together and the videos programs together for these events. Now that's even if there aren't changes or if there's one change. But when there's three changes, these folks have to, I'm going to guess, bust their butts to get that done in time for the broadcast in less than 24 hours. And so they did that. They accomplished a great deal before UFC 279 and getting those video packages together. So I want to praise the UFC production team for doing that because they did a great job in scrambling. And I would say the production team, while I sometimes quibble with what they put up there, the visuals are always strong and they do a good job in that respect. The UFC did a poor job in, I don't know what we're going to call this, but Dana White would have you believe that there was a near riot that canceled the pre-fight press conference. All I really saw was a bunch of guys, maybe one guy trying to kick another guy, and then a bunch of people yelling at each other from across a big echoing hall, and some plastic bottles of water being thrown around, and maybe some mean things being said. Kind of the norm of a UFC press conference these days. So it was weird to see White try and sell this as a big thing and then use the video footage that kind of showed us the truth of the situation to promote the fight. The truth being that this wasn't that big of a deal. So that was a big drop of the ball for the UFC. I mean, they could have sold the storyline, but the storyline kind of disappeared when the video came out and we saw what White portrayed as happening as not really happening. And Joe Rogan and Daniel Cormier have shown, and Cormier has gotten better at this, but Rogan really just kind of blew my mind here at UFC 279 when he asked during the broadcast, and this again is Joe Rogan, the guy who everyone holds up as the ideal UFC broadcaster, asked if there was a difference between a wrestling takedown and an MMA takedown. And by now, we know the answer to that is yes. We should have known that for a long time. But to bring this up in a broadcast is kind of inexcusable. And it just goes to show that Rogan really is not doing his homework on this. And this is something he should have known for a long time. But to bring it up in 2022, come on, man. I know Daniel Cormier likes to harp on takedowns and how that was a wrestling takedown and that wasn't a takedown. But the reality is, MMA takedowns are different than wrestling takedowns. And the big picture is takedowns by themselves don't score. They're a statistic to help people understand things and a statistic to put on the board. But in the big picture, they do not score. So to get all mad about what was and wasn't a takedown is kind of weird. But at least understand what is a takedown. That's all I ask. Understand what it is. Rogan showed that, once again, he doesn't understand the scoring and the stats of the sport that he is commentating on. And that's kind of weird, kind of sad. I saw a lot of people, and this includes the media, giving credit to the UFC for saving this event when Chimaev missed weight. And that's just flat out wrong. The only people that saved this event, and the only people that should be credited for this saving this event are the fighters. They all accepted at the top of the card. Those six fighters, and five, because Chimaev, he's the one that screwed this all up, so he doesn't get any credit because he's the one that created this chaos. But the other fighters, they accepted fights against opponents they did not train for, in some cases at weights they did not weigh in for, and so they should be credited with saving the event. And to credit Hunter Campbell for saving the event, that's just as bad as crediting Dana White and the UFC for saving the event. Hunter Campbell offered, I would guess, his role in this and the UFC's role in this is probably just offering a little more money to the fighters. Still not enough to make it 50-50 split. So don't credit the UFC. Don't credit Dana White. Don't credit Hunter Campbell. Credit the fighters. The fighters saved the fight card. And that's hard stop. Fighters saved this fight card. Daniel Cormier. And this is something that gets thrown around a lot, I think. And it gets thrown around incorrectly every time it gets mentioned. Cormier said that the Arizona Commission stole the title from the lightweight title from Charles Oliveira. That is 100% not true. Charles Oliveira missed weight for the title fight. That's true. Arizona Commission weighed him in. That's true. The fight, the title, the UFC title is a promotional title. It doesn't carry any weight with the Arizona Commission or with any commission. They do not care about those titles. It's a promotional title. The promotion took Charles Oliveira's title when he missed weight. To say anything otherwise is to be wrong. Daniel Cormier was wrong on this. The UFC took the UFC title from Charles Oliveira. Now, should they have done that? You can debate that. But to say that the commission took it is, it's wrong, flat out wrong. John Anik, usually I have nothing bad to say about John Anik, but when John Anik was talking about Hamza Chimaev at UFC 279, he mentioned that Chimaev was disciplined. And I think we saw a couple examples during fight week that Chimaev is not disciplined. One, he kind of tried to start a fight at the press conference. He tried to start a fight before the press conference with Paulo Costa. Two, he missed weight by 7.5 pounds. Three, he wasn't really upset about that at all. He kind of just shrugged it off and laughed. That was the end of that. And then he kind of blew everything off afterwards too. So discipline is not something I would put on Hamza Chimaev, at least not at UFC 279. If he gets his stuff together for the next fight, maybe I'll change my tune. But he was definitely, definitely not disciplined. And finally, the UFC and Dana White deserve to be criticized here for, and I'm going to do more of this a little later on the podcast here, for the way they handled the situation after the event and a little bit during the event. The UFC was heavy on the praise of Nate Diaz, but don't forget, the UFC did not want Nate Diaz to win. The UFC's plan was not for Nate Diaz to win. Look at the fight Chimaev fought against Holland. And Holland's not, maybe not in his prime right now, but I don't know if he's going to get better. But he's pretty close to his ultimate fighting abilities right now. The same cannot be said about Nate Diaz. The idea was for Chimaev to run over Diaz and send him out of the UFC damaged. Because that didn't happen doesn't mean the UFC was praising Nate Diaz. They had to spin the story a little bit here. And I'll cover this more. But to do so is transparent. And it was kind of gross. And anyone that was buying what White was selling was a sucker. Conor McGregor. So we know Conor McGregor hasn't fought since July. He fought twice in 2021. We think he's going to fight again sometime in 2023. We don't know when. He had teased a couple returns in 2022. I think it was April. He said he was back to striking. And then in July, he teased the July return. That didn't happen. And now he's going to be in the Roadhouse reboot. And from what we understand, 2023 is when the goal is to come back. McGregor has not been tested by USADA since the third quarter of 2021. And here are the numbers of McGregor's testing history, according to the USADA website. 2015, 8. 2016, 11. 2017, 6. 2018, 11. 2019, 7. 2020, 8. 2021, 11. And 2022, 0. I think his last fight, his last test came in third quarter of 2021. It's weird. It looks suspicious, especially when you consider there is one fighter who fought on the same event as McGregor who hasn't fought since then, and that is Yana Kunitskaya. And she's been tested three times in 2022. Other fighters who have been out of action longer, Tanner Boser, Wally Alves, Daniel Pineda, they've been tested three times each. John Jones, who hasn't fought since 2020, has been tested three times in 2022. And if you really want to dust off a couple names here, Travis Brown, who hasn't fought since 2017, was tested three times in 2022 so far. And Uriah Faber, who hasn't fought since 2019, he's been tested four times so far in 2022. So big picture, I don't care if McGregor is in the testing pool or out of the testing pool. But it looks terrible for the UFC and USADA when he hasn't been tested since 2021. If he's in the pool, this is. And that's a bad look for the UFC and USADA. I asked the UFC, McGregor's management, if he has withdrawn from the pool. Neither responded. USADA said that they defer to the UFC on matters like that. And I understand that. But look, if McGregor is in the testing pool and he's not being tested, That's a bad look, because he's the biggest name in the sport right now. Biggest name in the UFC. Biggest name in MMA, maybe. To not have him being tested at least once or twice when other fighters who are really inactive and probably not even expected to come back in the case of Faber or Brown, to not test McGregor is a bad look. I think my goal here of bringing this up isn't to shame McGregor or shame the UFC or USADA, but to kind of get some idea, is he in the pool or isn't he? Because if he's not, well, then we have a long time to wait before he's going to come back. We got to wait till he gets in the pool, and then he has to have 6 months of negative tests before he's eligible to fight. And so I think we could be in a situation where we're looking at a long time before Conor McGregor fights again. Do we know that situation is the reality, though? No, because no one's talking. Tony Ferguson, this one gets a exasperated sigh, a head shake, and definitely a come on now. In an ESPN story about Ferguson and UFC 279 and saving the event, Brett Okamoto detailed how Ferguson was thinking over the change in opponent when he told Chief Business Officer Hunter Campbell that he'd do some better thinking if he was driving Campbell's Bentley. And Campbell threw Ferguson the keys and said, "You take the car for as long as you want. I don't give a shit about the car." 45 minutes later, Ferguson came back and agreed to fight Diaz in the main event. And I guess this story was supposed to be cute or funny or something. It was neither. It was a reminder that Ferguson, whose blood, body, and brain helped pay for that car that Hunter Campbell said he doesn't care about, does not have a Bentley. And that's the bigger problem here. The UFC doesn't share in the spoils. And to say that I don't care about that car and just throw the keys, do whatever you want, Campbell might as well have been throwing a UFC fighter at Ferguson. And I know that's a strained analogy, but the reality is, if he doesn't care about the car that the fighters are paying for with their blood, their body, and their brain and their futures, how much do you think he cares about the fighters that are supplying the UFC with their revenue? He doesn't. He cares about the fighters in a sense that there's enough to book a card, but individually, these people don't mean much to the UFC. And that was what I got out of that exchange. That car that you paid for by fighting in a cage, doing a lot of damage to yourself and your future, that car doesn't mean anything to me. And therefore, you don't mean anything to me. He might as well have said that. And the reminder here is Tony Ferguson and every fighter should be able to afford whatever they want. The UFC shouldn't get all the spoils here. They do. The split should be 50-50. Right now, it's 80% of the UFC, 20% of the fighters. That's gross. It's wrong. It's not going to change until the fighters do something about it. I'm kind of beating my head against the wall on this enough to know that's the case. But this was just another reminder that the UFC does not care about the fighters, only that they provide the UFC with enough fighters to stage an event. That's the length of how much the UFC cares about the fighters. Dwayne Johnson. So now we know the UFC and Dwayne The Rock Johnson have a deal where the fighters have to wear The Rock's shoes. And Nate Diaz blasted the shoes as being crappy, but I don't know. I don't wear them, so I don't know that. But I do know the deal is bad. In pitching his deal with the UFC for the fighters to wear the shoes, Johnson said, "The values and foundation of Project Rock, they are so aligned with the values and the foundations of the UFC and the fighters." And that's a bunch of BS, because there's been enough talk by now from the fighters that they don't really see any kind of revenue. They don't see any cash from this. Now, the UFC might say, "Well, we're supplying you these shoes and that's part of your revenue package." And I'm sure that's the way it looks on the UFC's accounting sheets at the end of the year, that the fight kits and the outfitting and all that, that's part of the revenue on paper. The reality is the UFC fighter is going to want cash more than they're going to want a pair of shoes. I think by now, Johnson and the UFC have heard enough pushback from fighters, and Terrence McKinney was one of them, the most recent, and he wrote this on Twitter. "If you're a fan of what we do, make the deal favorable for the ones modeling your shoe. I get it's not your fault or your business doing it to us, but show us the love you think you are. Get in our corner and support us." So what I would hope, because Johnson, like I said, has obviously heard this by now, what I hope is that he would say, "All right, I need to get out of this deal or change this deal." I would hope that one of the two takes place. My preference would be to change the deal so the UFC fighters get compensated in cash for this. But if he backs out of the deal because the UFC won't make that deal, then that's fine too. But to represent yourself as being on the side of the fighters here, when the reality is they're not getting anything out of this except for a pair of shoes, which I don't think that they would want if they were offered the money. And that goes for the fight kits too. If you say I can give you an extra couple grand per fight, but you got to supply your own fight kit, fighters would probably do that, because how much are a pair of shorts? How much is a t-shirt? How much is a warm-up jacket? The cash is better than having some Venom branded gear you're not going to use other than to walk out to the fight for. The same with these shoes. So I'd assume Johnson at this point, if he's still in the deal, and I, from all indications, he is still in the deal, he either doesn't care or, well, there is no other option. If Johnson doesn't do something, it's clear that he thinks this is fine, that he thinks this is acceptable, and that he really doesn't care about the UFC fighters other than that, hey, they're wearing my shoe and I'm getting a bunch of free media for it. I have mixed feelings about Tony Ferguson's future. On one hand, I can understand why someone like Daniel Cormier would want him to retire. On the other hand, I can understand Ferguson thinks he can stay in the mix. He's 0-5 dating back to May 2020. Those losses have come to Justin Gaethje, Charles Oliveira, Benil Dariush, Michael Chandler, and now Nate Diaz. And if you want to go over the rankings of those fighters, Gaethje is number 3, Oliveira is number 1, Dariush is number 6, and Chandler is number 5, and that's in the lightweight division. I don't think Ferguson is washed up, but I think that fights like the Diaz fight are more in line with his level right now. And that's to say, we can go back to the RDA conversation where Rafael Dos Anjos said, I don't want to pursue the championship anymore. I want fun fights. I want entertaining fights. I want fights that satisfy me as a competitor. And this is the same kind of thing that Jim Miller is kind of doing too. And I think Ferguson fits well in that kind of group, in a veterans division, where you are just fighting. You got a name. The UFC can still promote you. The UFC can still use you as a main card fighter and maybe even a main event fighter in some of these fun fights. They don't really have an effect on the rankings. They don't really have an effect on the title picture, but they keep a veteran fighter who is a name, who can generate revenue for the UFC and for themselves in the mix. It's a good thing to have that. Now, if Ferguson thinks he's going to keep going out there and fight the top of the division, then I got to say pump the brakes a little bit, because I don't think Ferguson's at the level where he is going to be able to compete with those folks who have beat him outside of Diaz. He's not going to hang with a Chandler. He's not going to hang with a Gaethje. He's not going to hang with an Oliveira. He's not going to hang with a Dariush. But maybe a Jim Miller, maybe a Rafael Dos Anjos in 2022. Those fights make more sense. He's still competitive. He's still a draw. Big picture, Tony Ferguson should be able to fight if he wants to, but if he's going to say, I want to fight the best of the best and stay at the top of the division, I think the UFC needs to maybe tell him slow down a little bit and reset. However, I don't think the UFC will do that. I think the UFC will just match him up against young killers and get him damaged, and that's kind of what the UFC does. So we'll see if this works to anyone's favor, really. UFC President Dana White really laid the praise on Nate Diaz during the UFC 279 fight week, especially the UFC 279 post-fight presser, where he said he wished nothing for the best for Nate Diaz and his future endeavors. Don't buy that. Don't buy that. Because had the fight that was scheduled to happen happened, you would have saw Dana White being up at the press conference saying, this guy doesn't belong here. He got run over. Did you see what happened out there? He doesn't belong in the UFC anymore. He's washed up. He's past his prime. He's not going to fight for the UFC anymore. We're done with Nate Diaz. The only reason that White was singing the praises of Diaz was because the plans to have him get run over by Khamzat Chimaev fell apart when Chimaev missed weight. That's the only reason. Had the plans worked out the way the UFC wanted, you would have saw a totally different Dana White. You might not even have seen Nate Diaz at the press conference. It's hard to imagine White saying anything good about Diaz after the plans had worked out. I just can't see it. The plan was to have Chimaev destroy Diaz. And destroy is the right word here, because they wanted to destroy his reputation. They wanted to send him out of the UFC on a down note. They wanted to send him out of the UFC as a non-marketable entity, which wouldn't have happened because Diaz has so much goodwill in the sport that that wouldn't have happened anyway. But the desire was there. The want was there. They wanted to break him, send him out as damaged goods, and then say, good luck. Just because it didn't work out doesn't mean that that wasn't the plan. That 100% was the plan. So White spinning this as a positive, wishing Diaz well, that's not what he wanted. That's not what the UFC wanted. They wanted to send Nathan Diaz out as damaged goods in the hopes of driving down his prospects, of the hopes of driving down his value, and big picture, the hopes of re-signing him, probably, for less money. Because I can guarantee you, if there would have been any offers, the UFC would sign Nate Diaz back up in a heartbeat. Why? Because contrary to what Dana White said in 2014, and maybe he corrected this later, Nate Diaz is and has been a needle mover. That's the fact. The fact is also that the UFC wanted to send him out of the promotion as a fighter with no value. The plan didn't work, but the plan was there. It's despicable. It's disgusting. And you will not convince me that wasn't the whole idea of booking this fight from the get-go. And yeah, I know some people are going to say, well, Diaz signed the contract. Diaz wanted out of that contract, and this was the route for him to get out of that contract. John Nash said there is no sunset clause on Diaz's contract. With that, he needed to fight to get out of that contract. And so this was the way out. If there's no sunset clause, he needed to fight. Had he turned down the fight, his contracts get extended every time he turns down a fight. And so he wanted out. He had to take this fight more or less or wait for Conor McGregor. And again, we don't know when Conor McGregor's coming back. We don't know if Conor McGregor's coming back. This was his way out. Was he 100% forced to sign it? Not 100%. But if he wanted out of his deal, you kind of forced him to sign this deal. So no one looks good here from the UFC side. You can praise Nate Diaz all you want. You can say that you wish him the best. But the reality is, your actions in this situation, if you're the UFC, speak way louder than your words.